You're listening to the Katakalam Project on Katakalam Media. This is Che Ting Ye. Taiwan, as an island at the crossroads of civilizations, is bound to be in the middle of questions about identity and heritage. Today, we begin thinking about a central pillar of what drives our identities, the issue of language. In many ways, the languages we speak to who we are. The languages that our mothers and grandmothers taught us give us the link to the past from which we have come. But when those languages disappear, become extinct, what happens to that link to our past? Do we become someone else completely? Do our future paths diverge? To help us orient ourselves to think about these questions, we talked to filmmaker Anita Chang, a documentary filmmaker who has also taught in Taiwan and Hawaii. Her film Tongues of Heaven explores the stories of four young women in Taiwan and Hawaii in search of their native languages, which are facing extinction. We talk about her vision when she started out making the film, the issue of the will of our generation to relearn those languages, and how does that will respond to the pressure of communicating in the modern society, which asks us to speak official, the formal, or even civilized languages. Of course, Anita also shares her own personal experiences of dealing with multiple languages in her own heritage. Here is our interview. Anita, thanks, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great being here.
So the first question is, we know you've been screening your film Tongues of Heaven around the country, and so the latest one was at San Jose, and I'm just wondering how it go, and I'm sorry that I missed it.
Yeah, I think it went really well. You know, sort of a luncheon and, you know, a film viewing at the same time. So I didn't expect a lot of people to be sort of distracted and talking while the movie was going on. You know, it's a little different for a filmmaker to have that kind of engagement with their work. But then I kind of just thought, well, you know, this is another kind of way to show a movie, right? And then some of the people who wanted to pay attention to the movie sat in the front. And I had made Chinese subtitles to make it bilingual because I knew there was going to be a multilingual crowd. But then the DVD sort of stopped at around 45 minutes, so they had to put in the English version. Yeah, I know. So on the actual screening itself wasn't ideal, but I think that it started the conversation, you know, and awareness. And so I think that was really
great
about
it. Did people ask a lot of questions? What kind of questions were people interested in?
Yeah, you know, I thought there would be more questions from the elders. And of course, I don't know if it was a matter of because they didn't get to see the movie really, or because the language issue, you know. So, but I think that there were definitely concerns about what the government was doing, what the government responsibility might be in a case like this, in a situation of language endangerment. Let's see, there was one woman who I thought was really interesting. She grew up in a household that was, you know, part mainlander, part Taiwanese, and, you know, she could speak a little Taiwanese, but pretty much the household encouraged her to just stick with Mandarin. And I think she was trying to express to the audience the kinds of pressure that young people have in their homes from their parents that emphasize the main language for purposes of, you know, just survival.
Right. Uh-huh.
And yeah. And so we did talk a little bit about these notions of, you know, survival and what sort of the people in Taiwan kind of at this point, the situation they're at in terms of their relationship to their mother tongue.
I see. Wow. So before we sort of go into the questions of, I guess, as you mentioned, identity, survival, sort of practical considerations of language, just tell us a little bit more about Tongues of Heaven, the movie itself. I understand it's four people that sort of tell their stories about their interaction or their experiences with their mother tongues. Without sort of giving the ending away, obviously, how was their struggle with their mother tongue like? And what did they find at the end of their journey, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, Tongues of Heaven is a collaboration between four young indigenous women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two women from Taiwan and two women from Hawaii. And it's really about their individual stories and the process of thinking about their relationship to their heritage languages. And so while each four of them have very different stories and they kind of, you know, we spent 2 to 3 years filming,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's also they come together and discuss and try to connect and relate to their different concerns. Yeah, so that's what the movie generally is about. And of course, you know, there's a lot of complex elements that go into, you know, wanting to support a language, preserve it, keep it alive and passing it down, and a language that is not being used, or, you know, we say neglected.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there, you know, I when I was editing it, I had to think of all the, at least bring up those key pressure points, you know, where things get really debatable.
And so, you know? What are some of those pressure points? Is there one sort of debate that sort of sticks out in your mind from editing and watching the stories of these four women?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things that I realized that one of the women actually faced an issue with is the idea of will.
Okay.
So it's this idea of where you are aware that your heritage language is endangered. And of course, there's many ways to measure endangerment, but one of the things that I have read from various, you know, articles and kind of research in my research is that if the language is not being passed down, mm-hmm. you know, then it's generally endangered, mm-hmm. especially if that's happening across the speaker communities.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so I think one of the big issues, at least that does come up in the film, is this idea of will.
Uh-huh.
So the will of the young person to want to learn their language,
mm-hmm.
and to be a speaker and to maintain it.
And so the film poses the question, sort of, what do you lose when you lose your mother language, when you lose your heritage language? So after having made the film and talking to different audiences across the country, sort of, how would you now answer that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think for those who believe language and culture are intertwined, I think that, you know, that's pretty obvious that if you lose your language, you lose an aspect of, you know, the mm-hmm. culture that is contained in the language, or that the language, shapes,
mm-hmm.
right? Or brings forth, or, you know, in culture, right? So it's this kind of a Janus face relationship, I guess you could say. And then there are others who can comfortably separate the mm-hmm. two. Yeah. And so, but the question is left fairly open. And for the audiences to think about, you know.
Right.
I'm not sure if I'm
no, I mean, I think that's I think as a filmmaker or as a the sort of the creative force behind something, you always want to leave the audience or the recipient to come to their own sort of conclusions on this question that you pose. So I don't even know if that was a fair question to ask you. But
yeah, Yeah, and I think for each person, it's really different. I mean, again, language is a very personal decision relationship. So it's not like you can broadly, sort of say, oh, well, if you lose your language, you lose your culture. There are those people who feel very connected to their culture but don't know the language of their community, And of course, as we know, there are various depths to an engagement with culture that language allows. It does open the view much wider, that's another thing to consider too. Because my parents, for example, they're fluent speakers of Minnan, but they feel that they don't even have the level of their relatives, like the elders, their aunties, uncles, at all. The kinds of, the 25 ways to say the way a leaf moves, there's 25 ways to say that, And so it's you're missing a kind of an observation of the world.
No, I just was reminded of family friends, sort of people who are in their, I guess, 40s, mid-40s, have children, right? And these people, they speak Taiwanese or Minnan to each other, and then they speak Taiwanese to their parents, which are, in their 80s and 90s. But then to their child, they speak Mandarin. Now, this entire family lives in the United States, right? So it's almost like, well, if you're going to teach them a language that is not the mainstream language in where you live anyway, right? There's sort of this subconscious, oh, for the next generation, we're going to teach them Mandarin instead of Taiwanese, which we just speak naturally anyway, which is kind of an interesting observation, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened to me first, because my first language was Minnan. And then when I was 5, my mom switched to Mandarin. And then I started to learn, of course, English in school, but I have never lost the original, the emotions, the feelings that come with Minnan. And I can still understand it. So, and it's very different than Mandarin, which is I actually learned in college. It's actually for me a second language. And it's not to say you can't enter a culture once you start learning a language. It's just different when it's your first one, which is inseparable from learning about the world around you.
Definitely. Wow. So, I remember learning Taiwanese, Minnan, and Mandarin sort of at the same time because so I grew up in Taiwan when I was little. My parents both work, and my grandmother actually from my dad's side came to take care of me, and she only spoke Taiwanese, but my parents only spoke Mandarin to me. So to me, it was like, oh, there's like grandma language, and then there's like mom and dad language, right?
It's great.
And the two are actually pretty separate in my mind, yet I mean I could see the similarities and the sort of commonalities, but they were two separate languages in my mind, and I was able to retain them. But that's there's sort of grandma language or grandma culture almost, and then parent culture perhaps. Sort of just take changing tracks a little bit to more of the wider world or looking at things from a macro perspective. Some people believe that linguistic diversity, sort of, or preserving multiple languages within the country actually undermines unity and identity as one single nation, right? For example, encouraging the use of Taiwanese or Puyuma or Atayal or any of the other languages in Taiwan over Mandarin enforces separate and even often conflicting cultural identities. And I'm also thinking about the example in France where they used to have different languages like Catalan and Breton and Normandy and all these languages, and then they pretty much unified them to create a single French identity. So, how would you sort of respond to people who say, well, this is important that we have linguistic uniformity in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think being able to speak the lingua franca and speaking your heritage language is mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's already clear that, you know, children can, you know, learn multiple languages at the same time. You know, maybe their speaking might be a little bit delayed, but they can, you know, be fully bilingual, trilingual. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, I think, again, it can be a very political issue, obviously, as we know.
Right, right, yeah.
And, through human history and today, even. And so it's, it's really a country thinking about the people within its borders and what it is that they value and support, you know. And if, you know, and again, most language revitalization movements are grassroots, mm-hmm. meaning it didn't involve the government in the beginning, you know. And it's the speaker communities making a decision, hey, you know, we actually see that our language, well, one, it could be that it's not even around anymore. It's moribund, and we're going to, you know, bring it back into our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And there are those who see that it's actually endangered,
right.
and then want to think of ways that they can maintain it.
Right,
and you know, grow a community around it as well. So it's not just about the language, but you also do need speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just people who decide that they want to, you know, teach this to their children and pass it down. And then when you know, whether or not the government does support it or whether there's activism around it, you know, it just all depends on the context.
Right, and I mean, I guess coming from a background in law or background in policy, so I'm always thinking about how this affects government action, right? And so I'm thinking about on the Taipei Metro, there's when they make announcements, it's in Mandarin, Hakka, Holo, Taiwanese, and in English. And I think just even having that validation for a lot of people feels like, hey, my home language, the language I speak at home, or my grandma language actually is suitable for a public modern setting as well. And I think that actually made a lot of people realize, hey, this is actually something worth preserving. So I don't know, I would argue that in that sense, it actually creates more of a unified identity if you are more inclusive, right? But that's just kind of my opinion.
There's a certain symbolism of it because obviously
exactly, yeah.
the MRT mm-hmm. doesn't announce in the other 14, you know, indigenous languages, right? But what it does is at least it says, you know, it acknowledges that, hey, we're in a, you know, multilingual society.
Right.
At least it's a kind of a gesture towards that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that's actually quite important because, I mean, as I'm sure you've known from interviews and from the process of making the film that a lot of people feel that the reason why their language is being neglected or is because of political issues or political motivations.
And historical as well, right?
Right, right.
Because Taiwan's multiple colonial regimes that, you know, prevented certain languages from being used.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think that alone, I mean, uh-huh. if we were just to think of it in terms of, for example, the colonial regimes that affected the passing down of languages, we only need to think of the government being involved as, you know, a form of reparations.
I see.
You know, when Anchi's mother uh-huh. said that I blame the Ministry of Education for causing the loss of our language, there's uh-huh. something really powerful in that. I mean, you know, she's kind of saying the Ministry of Education was heavily involved in shifting our will to pass down our language to our children because we were afraid of, you know, possible punishment that they would receive. So then what is the obligation of a government then, you know, in a post-colonial condition, right? Like what is their obligation then to make amends? And if so, there needs to be some serious CPR going, right? That's what some,
right.
That's what some linguists will say. That's the term, you know? Or, you know, again, some committed efforts, you know?
Yeah, which brings me to this next question, which is just on language policy specifically, or even to a greater extent, multicultural policy in a single country, right? So we mentioned France, which basically in the 18, you know, in hundreds of years ago, decided to basically unify everyone. Then there's Belgium, which, as you know, splits the country into two distinct zones, one for sort of more Dutch-speaking, one for more French-speaking. And then there's a Singaporean model, which for allows sort of languages to coexist, but have sort of an unofficial lingua franca that takes dominance. So what is your ideal policy for a place like Taiwan if you were to be an advisor to the Minister of Education?
I'm just a filmmaker. I mean, I think one of the most difficult mm-hmm. things that I've observed living in Taiwan mm-hmm. in terms of young people who actually do have the will to learn their heritage language mm-hmm. is the teaching model mm-hmm. that they're faced with, you know. So some of the students feel that it's not effective, you know, or that it's hard to find teachers, you know. So I think the learning model, and I think that's probably something that might be able that's something that could be looked at more, mm-hmm. you know, especially if you know, they're not living in the villages, right? So like I had mentioned before, like the Maori in New Zealand mm-hmm. have this language nest situation, which I think has been fairly successful. And I think Taiwan is trying that right now, you know, but I think it's difficult for young people to gather and do that. You know, it's mostly within, it is connected to the school system, the language nest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and you know, I mean, Taiwan is just full of mountains and, you know, villages and mountains, and, you know, it's just, again, it's a little difficult to get to places sometimes. And
And I think the thing with Taiwan is that, I mean, not only when you have Hakka and Taiwanese, but you have this sort of just a number, a wide range of Aboriginal languages, and to varying degrees of in need of resuscitation, in a sense, right? And how do you sort of be inclusive of all that, yet not let one take dominance over another, right? So, no, I think those are all very interesting questions to think about, not only for policymakers, but for people working in the cultural sphere as well.
Yeah, for example, there's one woman in my movie, whose grandfather is one of 10 speakers of a language. And she is studying linguistics, and she is going to try to learn from her grandfather and document the language. So documentation is really important, you know, and there needs to be government resources for that. Because usually when a language is, there's one speaker remaining or just a few numbers of speakers remaining, I think, you know, linguists, you know, are really tasked with documenting it as accurately as possible, you know, for, you know, for possible use in the future or as.
I am, you know, I'm just sort of hoping for some sort of mainstream. I mean, and other thing, mainstream media, mainstream movies and TV shows are now featuring more of these heritage languages in Taiwan than, you know, any time in the past. So I think that's a good sign as well. When people see, you know, good looking actors and actresses speaking in their heritage language, I think that's kind of cool. So just lastly, do you have any ideas or plans for future projects on this topic or on any other topic? What interests you? What's on your mind these days?
I haven't thought too much. I think lately, I'd really like to actually just do some oral history work just within my own family.
Okay.
Especially my parents.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think, when I interviewed my grandmother, it was just too late. I had wanted to interview her for 10 years, and she was not very receptive to it. Part of it was she didn't see her life was interesting. And then also, I kind of wasn't the granddaughter that she had really hoped for. So there's all these tensions to be able to have access, to my grandmother. But then when she was ready to be interviewed, she had a stroke. So I don't want the situation to get to that point with my parents. So it's, not taking them for granted, while they're still healthy and their memory is strong. And so that's something that I want to do. I don't know if it'll become a movie or anything. I'm particularly interested, though, in my parents' relationship with Indigenous people and indigeneity in Taiwan, growing up in different parts of Taiwan. My father on the West Coast in Holi, and my mom in the South in Pingtung. So I'm really, curious to kind of get that part of the history. Yeah.
Yeah, I really hope we had more time to talk, but I think we're good on time right now. So Anita, thanks so much again for sharing your work on Tongues of Heaven and also your thoughts about language and identity in Taiwan.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. You've been listening to the Katagalan Project on Katagalan Media. This is Che Ting Ye. Find us on our website at katagalanmedia.com. That's KetaGalanMedia.com. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time.